We're going to be thinking about this subject of atheism. Now, I know that many of us, indeed most of us here, probably are not of that view, but this talk is directed particularly to someone, and there may be some here, who are not convinced on Christian things. So, I welcome you if you're in that position. I really do. We're not here to in any way personally attack any atheist. In fact, I have a secret sort of respect for at least the fact that they're seeking, some of them, not all of them are, but some of them are seeking to sort of just come clean and say, well, I'm driven by evidence and I don't see the evidence. Now, I personally think there are problems with it, as you will see, but at least they are opening up as to what they're really thinking, right? So I do commend you if that's the case, and there may be one or two here who have come, particularly because this meeting is not meant primarily, as the title suggests, for a Christian. It's meant for somebody who's doubting. So for those of you who've come as Christians, you want to learn more about the biblical view of creation, we'll be dealing with that, of course, on Sunday, and tomorrow we'll be dealing with some of the evidence again. So if you're in either camp, you want to come to tomorrow's meetings, you're welcome, because we'll be looking at the rocks, as we were just told about earlier, and we'll be looking at the evidence from hearing, which is another area of science which I've dealt with. So please do come. You are more than welcome. You're welcome on Sunday as well. So whatever camp you're in, you're welcome to these meetings, because we're seeking to be driven. Initially, in this meeting, we're not being driven, first of all, by the Bible, right? So we're not assuming that, but we're going to look at the reasons why I think that you've got to be skeptical about atheism. It doesn't really fit. And what am I going to say to that? Well, it brings, I'm going to be saying, no coherence to the science, logic, meaning and truth, and then morality. Before I really do get going, just remind you of those DVDs at the back. There's a whole string of them. I think there's about 11 of my titles at the back. And these are just, I'm just simply seeking to give a reasonable price to them. We thought about $5 for those. Haven't brought many of these, but there are some booklets, pocket guides, which are, what did we say we'd make these? $5 again. $5 for those. And please have a look at them afterwards. And this one, it's got pounds on the front, but it's actually being sold in dollars, so you don't have to go out to the little hole in the wall and get pounds, because I don't think you use those here anymore. 1776 changed a few things. But there we go. Should Christians embrace evolution? I've just got 4 copies of that, and that will go at $15. So, let's now just talk about this issue. I want to show you that logically it doesn't make sense, particularly in the second section, as you can see, but even in the science and the other issues. So there's Dawkins saying there's probably no God on his buses in London some years ago. Now stop worrying and enjoy your life. But of course he had to put in the word probably. And we're going to see that actually there's a lot of things which don't work. It brings no coherence to the science. Let me start by mentioning biology and what's called abiogenesis. It's one of the big issues in science taken from an atheist point of view. And many people today think you can only do science from an atheist point of view. I'm going to show you that actually atheism is essentially a philosophy. And it's almost at the point really of being a religion in its own right. And atheism, far from being, we're just neutral. Atheism is not neutral. Atheism is taking a position. And when people say you can only do science from an atheist position, you've already given the game away. Because science actually has a world view. You have a thesis which you want to prove. You're not quite sure whether it's true, so you call it a hypothesis. That's the way science works. So you have a suspicion that it's working along this line or whatever it is you're looking at, and you do experiments to test that. And eventually, once you've done enough experiments, then the hypothesis now becomes a theory because you've tested it and gauged a number of experiments. And to be, it looks as though it's actually working in virtually every experiment that you've been doing, and so the theory never quite becomes a fact, but it does become a robust theory, and that's as far as the science goes. NASA down the road, with some people here working at NASA, who've already been telling me they work there, you know, using all the theories of Kepler, worked out where the planets and the moon in particular would be for the launch, the great big launch which took place way back in the 1960s, which led eventually to man being on the moon. Now, all that was done because observations had been made. That's observational science, which tests and makes predictions based on a theory which has been proven so often to be true. Now, that's the way science really works. But when you're looking at life coming from non-life, this is all to do with people's ideas. There's no way, until you actually do it, that you could test this thesis, that you could get life from non-life. And everything is indicating that you can't do it. This is one of the basic machines in the cell which you've got to have. If you don't have this, you're dead in moments. In fact, you're dead in milliseconds if you didn't have these working. In every single cell of every living thing, even plants, have this. It's called adenosine triphosphate. Don't need to worry about all the technical details, except to notice that you've got a gradient of what's called protons, hydrogen, nuclei, which are crossing a membrane, and they're taking in, these hydrogens, by the way, are going one by one and driving what is rather like an electric motor. Indeed, it's called an electrostatic motor. Faraday would have been proud of this if he'd found it in his day. He looked at electromagnetism. This isn't electromagnetism, but it's similar. It's a motor driven by a proton gradient. And it's actually converting food into energy in the cell. And it's absolutely vital for stringing up things like DNA. You've heard of DNA? Deoxyribosic nucleic acid. You probably, most of you have heard of it because so many people have seen programs on PBS and other stations which have been talking about this on the television. Now, the DNA will only string up and what we call polymerize because of what I've just shown you, ATP. If you didn't have ATP, you wouldn't be able to make the long molecules which are absolutely essential for DNA, which stores the information in the cell. And these things are well known, that DNA won't actually link up together unless you've got ATP to actually add the energy which is needed. I won't go into all the detail here, but it's phosphate bonds, if you want to look it up. The phosphate bonds won't come together unless you've got the ATP. And the ATP comes along and gives it an extra kick, which makes these links like Lego take place. Okay? That's what's going on. The technical term is to polymerize the DNA. If you want a little bit more detail, the phosphate bonds come in what we call monophosphates naturally. In order to energize them, you've got to make them become triphosphates. And the molecule which does that is the molecule I've just shown you, which is ATP. Nothing is going to work unless those two things are working in harmony together. So when people suggest that life can come from non-life, they've got to suggest how this amazing molecule, which on its own is very, very unstable, ATP will just break up. You can't sort of come along and say, here's some ATP. The ATP will actually just disintegrate unless it's part of the cell. Similarly, DNA disintegrates. They're both unstable. There's far more to it than I've been saying. The cell will not operate unless all this machinery is operating together. So I would suggest to you that life is driven by the whole system of interlocking cellular machinery, which has really only been discovered since Crick and Watson discovered DNA in the 1950s. And they thought that they were making a massive discovery. Of course they were. But then people realized there was far more complication than just the DNA. There was all the other machinery, the ATP that I've just shown you, and many other things, which really is showing that there is a complete... It's a bit like software and hardware in a computer. All these things are not going to work. The making of triplets of nucleotides for the DNA is not going to work unless you've got the DNA to begin with. That is the phosphate bonds on the outside part of the DNA. And you know that triplets of nucleotides code, because of cytosine, adenine and thymine being in a particular order, codes for a particular amino acid, and there is a special further machinery which links up all these amino acids together to make the proteins of which are essential in your bodies. It's an amazing cellular machinery which is going on, and it's the whole system which is operated digitally effectively because of these nucleotides which are controlling the software, as it were, the instructions to say that stands for go and get a particular amino acid and string it together until we finally make a protein. So there aren't just two fundamental issues. There are actually three. The atheist will say that the universe is just matter and energy. But he's wrong. He's wrong. Just plain wrong. The universe is not just made of matter and energy. Just like a computer is not just made of hardware. By the way, I've been converted. I became a Christian when I was in 1969. But you know, I was converted again in a different area. I suddenly started using Mac computers. You'd have thought that with a name like Macintosh, I would have always used a Mac. But I left Microsoft behind, and I'm so pleased I did, in 2014. And I wondered, why on earth did I take this on before? Steve Jobs is no longer with us, did a very good job in having a very stable software which runs these systems. Unlike Microsoft, which when you press the start button, you know, it stops and then you have to press it again to get it started, and maybe 5 minutes later it might work, right? These sometimes do crash. Even Apple Macs do sometimes crash. And if it crashes, I just turn it off and turn it on again. And it just comes back almost immediately to where it was. Do you know why? Because it's got a very good Unix-based software system. And that was clever. But it's the software which makes the difference. We can actually get another program to make it run, if you really wish to, make it run like a PC. But I only do that occasionally because some people bring stuff, you know, from the old-fashioned Microsoft stuff. And, you know, I have to make it look like it again. And we manage, but really this is the advanced system. And I find the software is brilliant because it's controlling the hardware much better. And the point I'm making underneath all these smiles about Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and all the rest of it is that software is very important. So you haven't just got matter and energy, have you? You've got information. And the issue of information is the big no-no in the scientific laboratory in biology. Let me give you just one little bit of an example. I went to a conference one again. It was in the States. It was up in near, not far from Chicago. And I was at this conference, and they were discussing protein folding. And I thought, oh, I'll go along to that because I'm interested in the protein folding. Because one of the things that they haven't yet worked out is why the proteins, which I've just talked about, you've got this string of amino acids, but then they all fold, and there is only one way that they can fold to get it right. Okay? How do they do it? Nobody knows. They're working on it. But they say, well, maybe it's the thermodynamics which is driving it. No, it's not. And I know it's not. What's driving it is software which hasn't yet been found. And I mentioned this at the meeting. You could have felt, as it were, the eyes looking at me with sharp razor blades, you know, coming, look at me. Who do you think you are? Say that sort of thing. We've been working at this for years. And you say that it's a software. I say, well, software is not hardware, is it? Nobody wanted to take the point up. So I left them to their devices. But it was quite evident that they weren't prepared to open their minds to the issue that software is not hardware. It's not the chemistry which is driving the protein folding. Because you're actually, I won't go into all the detail, but you're actually going uphill. Chemical energy is not there to drive it. In order to get those proteins to fold in a particular way, you've actually got to go through energy barriers. But you've got to do it in such a way that it's organized by software. That's really what's going on. And nobody's fully resolved it yet. They're writing loads of papers on it, but I believe they're going in the wrong direction. Because they're driven by a wrong philosophy. Richard Dawkins does sometimes get things right. And he said this, what lies at the heart of every living thing is not a fire, warm breath, nor a spark of life. It is information, words, instructions. Think of a billion discrete digital characters. If you want to understand life, think about digital technology. And he's actually correct, for once. Because information is not the same as matter and energy. He doesn't draw the right conclusions from it, but he is correct on that point. Hardware does not write software, right? So if I play this lovely piece of music, which should be playing now, you recognise that music? It's Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto. But who wrote Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto? Was it the violin? No, of course it wasn't. Neither was it the paper and the score here. It was a mind brilliantly thinking of this music which wrote it. And the software is rather like that with hardware. The hardware doesn't write the software. The software organises the hardware. So I'd love to carry on listening to that, but you know that that's just an illustration. One of the very clever minds, who's now died some years ago in 1976, was Michael Polanyi, and he said this, whatever may be the origin of a DNA configuration, it can function as a code only if its order is not due to the forces of potential energy. Well, that could be chemical, physical, physical energy of some kind, or electrical energy. Then he goes on to say, it must be as physically indeterminate as the sequence of words on a printed page. What's this saying? I'm stretching your minds a bit here, but I really do want to stretch them, because this is an important point. If you say that the DNA codes for proteins simply because of chemistry and physics, you've lost the plot, you see. It's not the chemistry and the physics which is dealing with the coding. It would be indeterminate. You could have organized a different code and it could still have worked. Right? It's not that. It must be physically indeterminate. In other words, you could put the letters wherever you wish, and it could still operate as a DNA system. But it's because the coding itself is telling you that it's, as it were, transcendent to the chemistry and the physics. Let me stretch you a bit further. Whoops. You might like that picture. When you mention the word thermodynamics, most people switch off. The more I think, the more confused I get, this poor little child is saying. If you want to know more about information, which I'm going to touch on now, and thermodynamics, you can look at one of my papers, which was written some years ago, which was basically making the point that information and entropy are connected. That actually information sits on a system which is not thermodynamically neutral. It's not something which is really in equilibrium, we would say. And that was the point of that paper. And I was seeking to show in that paper that thermodynamics is actually at the root of this issue of information. Thermodynamics is being organized by the information. It's not the thermodynamics which is driving the information, which was basically Polanyi's point that I mentioned earlier. So if you're involved in some of the industries in this area, particularly NASA, of course, and others, industries which are, I know, are operating in Alabama, then you'll appreciate some of the points that I'm making. And if you want to pick me up on this afterwards, feel free to do so. But there are people thinking into this area who've missed the connection of thermodynamics with information. The information constrains the energy flow to not be in equilibrium. And it's driven by the information in the system. It's not the other way around, which is, of course, what many of the atheist scientists wish to say. Let me now just come on to another issue. Because some people are saying that the universe came about from nothing. Have you heard this? We've got people like, you probably don't know him, but in England he's a big shot, Peter Atkins, who has the audacity to say, I mean, he's a very good chemist, I'm not doubting that for a moment, that he's a very clever man. But he has the audacity to say in his book, Creation, just called Creation, the universe can come into existence without intervention. Is that really true? And you've got Stephen Hawking, I'm sure you've heard of him, who's saying something very similar. He said, because there are laws such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going. Really? Stephen, Peter, are you out of your mind? Because surely you are making an important error. Because you are now confusing, as John Lennox says, I don't agree with John on everything, but he's right on this, you are confusing the laws of physics, particularly in Stephen Hawking's quote, and the matter of an agency to get that system, which we're talking here about the universe itself, going. Let me read to you Lennox's correct assessment of what Stephen Hawking says. Contrary to what Hawking claims, physical laws can never provide a complete explanation of the universe. Laws themselves do not create anything. They are merely a description of what happens under certain conditions. What Hawking appears to have done is to confuse law with agency. His call on us to choose between God and physics is a bit like someone demanding that we choose between aeronautical engineer Sir Frank Whittle and the laws of physics to explain the jet engine. You've got to have an agent. The laws of physics don't do anything. They just simply describe what happens once something starts going. But it doesn't explain agency. So Stephen Hawking made a crass mistake. And it's a very fundamental mistake. The laws of physics will never build a universe on their own. Just lastly, it brings no coherence to science concerning the engineering structures in living systems. I won't be speaking about this in any of my other talks, but I do sometimes speak on flight. And I have here a feather. Richard Dawkins famously has written so many books. One of his books is called The Greatest Show on Earth. And he was interviewed once by, not a Christian, but interviewed by a person who was a skeptic himself. And he was interviewed about the feather. And in the interview, and the program was called A Brief History of Disbelief, and you'd hardly say that that title was neutral, was it, in its statement? A Brief History of Disbelief. Jonathan Miller interviewed Richard Dawkins 10 years ago. And he asked him about the origin of the feather. And he was asking him particularly about the way the feather works. Because if you know anything about the feather, when you put it under a microscope, you find that individual barbs are connected. Have you ever asked the question why, when you press against it, all the barbs keep on together, unless you push really hard, you can't separate them. They're kept together by barbules, which in one direction have hooks on, and in the other direction have ridges on. Well, that's a very clever mechanism. And it would be foolish to suggest that somehow a frayed scale of something like a reptile, dinosaur, or whatever it is that evolutionists are going to say is the precursor to birds, somehow a frayed scale gradually set up a mechanism such that on the vertical part of my picture here, these had hooks on, and the horizontal barbules, and you only see this under the microscope, had ridges on, a bit like a curtain rail going over, a curtain hooks going over a curtain rail. Now, that is just basic biology. And Richard Dawkins, as I say, was pressed on this, and he said, I suppose it is a matter of faith on my part. Now, he was actually also redefining faith. In fact, he was saying that faith is not based on evidence. And it shows to you the weakness of his position as an atheist. Because faith is, from a theist position, a Christian position, is placed on what we know, not what we don't know. And when I look at the structure of a feather, and you can see here the barbule with hooks on, sliding over barbules with ridges on, I, with my engineering mind, look at that and I say, that's got to be a clever system. A clever bit of engineering, which implies that there is an engineer. Do you see the point? The evidence is actually pointing in the opposite direction, and Dawkins tries to redefine faith in order to make it sound as though he is the person who is following evidence. He's not. He's actually not following the evidence. And he's saying, I hope it's going to be something different. There is no system which can explain that by Darwinist principles. Everything is telling you that the Darwinist system doesn't work. As Philip Johnson, who wrote the book Darwin on Trial, said, Darwinist evolution is an imaginative story about who we are and where we came from, which is to say it is a creation myth. And he's correct. It is today's creation myth. There have been creation myths all down the centuries. Evolution is just another creation myth. It's a philosophy overlaying the science. The science is not actually justifying the Darwinian position. Let me move on because I want to cover some of the other points that I made. Not only does it not bring coherence to the science, it doesn't bring coherence to logic and rationality. Remember I talked to you a bit about the DNA. We've already established that that codes for the proteins. We've already established that there are three fundamental quantities, not just matter and energy, but information. Now let me ask you a bit more about this, because now I'm going into what is logic itself. We saw evidence in the DNA, as I touched on it, of a logical system at work. But it's not the only place where we use logic. I'm seeking to use logic now as I speak to you. As you speak back to me in your questions, and I hope you will have them at the end, I hope that you will use English. That might be a slightly mutated sort of English over here, but you know, it is English, and it's using a coded system of, you know, noises going up and down. Sometimes I have to listen carefully to make sure I've understood the accent, but it's essentially a sort of English, right? And you write it slightly differently as well, but we'll get through, don't we? We're separated, as Churchill said, by a common language. But we know all about that. But now, that language is using a voice, my larynx, and your ears are hearing those sounds. We'll talk about more about the ear tomorrow. And when we write it down, that coded symbols, which we write down, that is not the same as the material of the pen or the paper that we're using. Just as with the spoken language, the noises, right, or the larynx, or the ear that I will talk about tomorrow, is not the same, but it's being used to hear, as the interruptions and the noises which are coming through the air, okay? So whether it be verbal or written, the coded system is not the same as the material which it's using. Are you with me? That's an important point, because once you've understood that point, you've then got to think about this next point. If we were speaking in French, which I can't do, parlez-vous is about all I can do, you know, then we're still using the same structure of larynx, if it's spoken. I mean, indeed, with French, we're using essentially the same letters, except you have acute signs and grave signs and all the other stuff. But essentially, it's the same letters. But they're rearranged differently, and the coded system is different, but it could be the same message, particularly if you're translating from English to French. Do you see the point here? That communication is not driven by the paper, if we're talking about writing, it's not driven by the pen. It's transcending and using the pen and the paper, or the computer these days and whatever, but it's not driven by the computer system or by the pen or by the paper. Polanyi, that I mentioned earlier, was making the same point about DNA. It's not the physics and the chemistry which is driving that protein coding system. It's got to be indeterminate, he says. And he's quite right. Which showed immediately that software is not the same as hardware. Well, it's the same point when you come to now thinking about how we think and how we speak and how we communicate. I'm now talking about really the brain and the vehicle that we are using to communicate. Now, where does all this come from? If you want to know more about this, Werner Gitt, who's a brilliant German scientist, wrote this paper, Information, the Third Fundamental Quantity. And he's also written a book, In the Beginning Was Information. I haven't got his stuff here, but you can order it on the internet. Brilliant mind. He actually talks about five levels of communication in true information systems. I've only just picked out two of them. So was Crick right when he said this? He was the one who found DNA with Watson. He said, you, your joys, your sorrows, your memories, your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behaviour of a vast assembly of nerves and cells and their associated molecules. Is that right? This is a worldview assumption. And science is filled with people who make assumptions based on worldviews which can be questioned. You see, Crick is not right. Because if Crick were right, then if I had a big enough computer and I was able to look at, say, Pastor Oliver, and I was able to analyze all the neurons which were flying around in his brain, I would be able to predict what he's going to say next. Particularly if I was to examine the rice and the chicken that we ate at lunchtime, and track all the chemical pathways which that system had been going through in his body, I could then say, yes, he's going to come out with these words. Well, that would be stupid, wouldn't it? Because you would have then destroyed the whole basis for rational thought. I know I may be stretching your minds here, but I need to, because I haven't even mentioned the soul yet. And if you are an atheist here, I'm simply talking to you about where does rationality come from? And it's a very important point. And many philosophers have realized this over the decades. And they are not necessarily Christians. Here's a scientist who was writing in the 1920s, who was certainly no Christian. Haldane. He was a very good chemist in his day. And this is what he said. If my mental processes are determined solely by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true. Do you get the point? Because I could just say it's due to the peas I ate for breakfast the other day. That's basically what he's saying. And hence, I have no reason for supposing that my brain is composed of atoms. In other words, I've got no way of testing whether what I'm saying represents a rational thought. Now, if you really think about this, this is a very, very powerful point. And we have here the total fallacy of the atheist position. And there are some atheists who are honest enough to admit this. I'm coming to one who I'll mention it. From this side of the water, who admits this? C.S. Lewis began life as an atheist. In fact, he was an atheist for a good part of his youth. But he then realized the fallacy of atheism. Because he said, if nature is quite powerless to produce rational thought, he was not a scientist, but he was making a very important philosophical point. Then he says, not that she never modifies our thinking, so if I've had some peas for breakfast which disagreed with me, I might feel that, oh dear, I'm not sure I can really grasp the mathematics I'm meant to be doing today. So it might modify my ability to do things. But it cannot be the origin of rational thought. Because if it was, it ceases for that very reason to be rational. For as we've seen, a train of thought loses all rational credentials as soon as it can be shown to be wholly the result of non-rational causes. In other words, if it was due to the peas that I ate for breakfast, then forget rationality. If it was the carrots, if it was the meat, you know, if there's any cause which is physics, chemistry, biology, then forget rationality. And the person that I was talking about, this side of the water, who is one of the most honest atheists that I heard of and know of. He's in New York City, and he's a brilliant person. He wrote the book Mind and Cosmos, which I recommend that you get. Because he is a first-class thinker today. He's not a Christian, but he realizes that there is a fallacy in this position which says that all the universe is just physics and energy. Evolutionary naturalism provides an account of our capacities that undermines their reliability, and in so doing undermines itself. He's right. And he knows he's right. He says we're missing something. Now, he's not yet said that he believes in God, but he knows full well that he's on a road which can lead that way. Rationality, as I say, whether it be E equals MC squared, whether it be X equals minus B plus or minus the square root of B squared minus 4AC all over 2A, which is the solution of the quadratic equation, whatever it is, or whether it be just simply English spoken in an English accent being told to an American audience who are just about understanding my English accent and, you know, putting in the mutation so that they do understand it, whether it be that rationality or whatever it is, it's the mark of mind. So atheism doesn't start with no God. Do you know what atheism starts with? It starts with freedom. I'm a free thinker. I think for myself. No God. No authority. No foundation for truth. Does that mean they don't believe in truth? Aha. That's a very important point. Nagel does believe in truth. But he knows he hasn't got a basis for it. Now, of course, you'll always get some hedonistic atheists who say, ha, not interested in truth, just live for the moment, pleasure-seeking. You'll always get those. But amongst the atheist community, I'm after those who are really searching for truth. And those know full well that this line of reasoning, they cannot get away from. They know they have no foundation for truth. They know that if you say we're just molecules, that of course means then it leads to their position, which they like, of course, no soul, just genes, no individuality though, because the molecules and the genes in you are essentially the same as the molecules and the genes in me. So where does my individuality come from? And molecules don't come with a little label saying, I belong to Andy McIntosh. Or I belong to Dean Olive. Or I belong to, I've just got to know Kevin there. What defines Kevin? What defines Dean? What defines Andy? Ah, Thomas Nagel. What defines Thomas? Molecules can't define. They have a real problem. They started with freedom. And it's a well-known philosophical point, but a very important one. That if you start with freedom, you get a contradiction. Because the laws of physics and chemistry are almost predictable. Even in a quantum system, essentially, you can still say what the chemistry and physics is going to do. And so you end up with incoherence. Now, this is a very, very crucial point. Chesterton, and by the way, I'm not agreeing with all these people that I quote. I don't agree totally with Lewis. I don't agree totally with Lennox. And I certainly don't totally agree with Chesterton. But they were clever minds, and they put their finger on issues. G.K. Chesterton said, take the first more obvious case of materialism. As an explanation of the world, materialism has a sort of insane simplicity. It has just the quality of a madman's argument. We have at once the sense of it covering everything, and the sense of it leaving everything out. Contemplate some able and sincere materialist. Dawkins, Jerry Coyne, all these people strutting around. Lawrence Krauss from the University of Arizona, laughing at Christians for believing that God created the world. Contemplate any one of those, right? And you will have the sense that something's wrong, this unique sensation. He understands everything, he says, but everything doesn't seem worth understanding. What's the point of life? His cosmos may be complete in every rivet and cogwheel, but still his cosmos is smaller than our world. The our world there is referring to the world of a theist who believes in a transcendent God. See that picture there? Lot of reds and greens. You say, what on earth is that? You could analyse it. If it was a painting, you could look at the pigment, and you could analyse the pigment of the red, and you could even say where the red pigment came from, you could say where the green pigment came from, you could analyse it, but you wouldn't have understood what it is. Come back a bit, you might begin to say, oh, what there's something going on here. There's lots of reds and greens. You could describe it to your heart's content, but would you have understood what the picture was? Not until you step right back. Ah! It's a painting. It's all about Monet looking at a poppy field. Do you see the point that Chesterton is saying? He understands everything, but everything doesn't seem worth understanding. You see, you could be a materialist, and you could get your naturalist ideas correct, but you haven't understood the whole basis of reality. Because reality is more than matter and energy. I like this little drawing. You see, you may be perfectly content soaring away, saying, there is no God. I'm not part of the tree. I'm just sitting on this tree trunk. And I can soar away to my heart's content. But there comes a moment of truth, does there not? You see, the philosophy of naturalism undermines the whole basis of naturalistic thought. Nagel understood that. Haldane understood it. C.S. Lewis understood it. You see, atheism brings no coherence to truth and meaning. It says that that's the whole of reality, when in fact the whole of reality is much more. He tries to insist that the reality is that, and he tries to deny that there is a possibility, even, that a mind is behind the universe that he's looking at. I have great issues with the scientific train in my country and in yours. I was at a meeting once in Georgia, not far away from here, and I came just to do a talk on my work on the Bombardier Beetle at Georgia Tech. And then I heard whisperings that people were worried. They said, do you realise, you looked at this person, who he is that you've invited? I've just come to do my talk on my science. And, you know, they were at the point of cancelling my meeting. Simply because they knew I was a Christian. Or they just found out. And what's more, he's a Christian who actually believes that God made the world. As if that somehow would undermine the science that I was going to present on the Bombardier Beetle research. Science cannot make a statement on everything. You cannot close down the possibility that there is a creator in the name of science. Science is neutral. And if the scientific evidence supports a creator, we must consider it. We cannot be like Richard Lewontin, who in the New York Review, way back in 1997, says, materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. You cannot do that. Richard Lewontin is wrong. Because that would be saying that science can only be done from an atheistic mindset. And that is patently wrong. Science has to be simply neutral. And if we follow where the evidence leads, it actually shows to us that really Lewontin was making a religious statement and that the evidence really supports that there is a God behind everything. Here's some fish. Superior being. Very silly idea. This is our world. And we are masters of our own destiny. Believe me, I know. I have a book here which says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Psalm 100 of that same book says that we didn't make ourselves. I believe the evidence is overwhelming that there is a mind behind us. Mainly because of this argument about rationality. were clearly made in the image of a brilliant mind. Let me just push this point about meaning as I draw it to a close. I like this cartoon which was sent to me. I can't remember when it was. I think it was one of my birthdays. Anyway, I probably lost the original card, but I took a picture of it. It was brilliant. Insightful. Compelling. Exemplary. In comes the cleaner. You know what she says? Upside down. You see, in a world which has lost its base for thought, in a world which has now become relative, where absolutes are no longer there, in a world where the Ten Commandments are taken away from this state's courtroom in a ceremonial way and dumped, we've got no basis now for saying what's right and wrong. There was a book by Ruckmayer, Modern Art and the Death of a Culture. He was writing in a day when people like Picasso were doing their paintings. In the day when Francis Schaeffer from this country was writing his books. And he was living in the day, and all these three were living in days, which was the initial breakup of absolutes. Picasso is famous for his pictures, and I don't particularly enjoy them, but this one I find very telling. The Crying Woman. And it's a desperate piece of art saying, what is meaning in a meaningless world? And atheism cannot give meaning. All the atheist cries, yes, I can give meaning because we are human. And the humanist society in Britain is very strong, the British Humanist Association. In fact, I debated the chairman of the Northern Ireland Humanist Association about 10 days, 2 weeks ago. And I made this point. I said, how can you give meaning when you don't believe in an absolute meaning? But meaning comes from my relationships one with the other. But what are those relationships? You're just flying molecules, flying neurons. Where is your meaning? What is meaning and truth? But the book I've been quoting says this, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And the central person of this book says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Now, the humanists will say, oh, well, I don't believe it. Okay, you don't believe it, but just a minute. Did that person say it or didn't he? And was he out? Had he lost his marbles? Was he mad? You see, you really have only got three options. He was either totally mistaken and he'd lost his marbles, mad, or else he was evil and he was just drawing attention to himself, that he was bad. You haven't got the option of saying that he was just a very great fellow, but he made mistakes. Because then you're saying that he's wrong. Are you going to try and make out that he was just a good guy, but he somehow got it wrong and he ended up on a cross? You've only got one option out of the three, really. And that is, he was who he said he was. You see, atheism not only doesn't bring meaning and truth, it doesn't answer the question of morality. Now, of course, people don't like me going here because they say, well, morality, I decide morality. Do you? Who says that we decide morality on our own basis? Who says that I decide my own gender? Who says that that's true? You know, Schrödinger was one of the most brilliant scientists who understood quantum mechanics. Schrodinger's wave equation. But look at what he said. I'm very astonished that the scientific picture of the real world around me is very deficient. He's an honest atheist. It gives a lot of factual information, puts all of our experience in a magnificently consistent order, but it is ghastly silent about all and sundry that is really near to our hearts, that really matters to us. He's crying out, honestly, as an atheist, saying, it doesn't fit everything. That's what he's saying. It cannot tell us a word about red and blue, bitter and sweet, physical pain and physical delight. It knows nothing of beautiful and ugly, good or bad, God and eternity. Science sometimes pretends to answer questions in these domains, but the answers are very often so silly that we are not inclined to take them seriously. How right Schrodinger was. How brilliantly put. Now, who would say to me that Schrodinger was not a brilliant scientist? It was due to him and due to Maxwell and other very great scientists, Maxwell actually was a Christian, that they could understand the science. But they maintained that not everything worked. It doesn't match everything in my experience. I debated this guy some while ago, back in 2010. Sadly, he's died of cancer now. But when I debated William Provine, I found him one of the most affable people from New York State in Cornell University. He famously made these points. He, by the way, comes from a Christian family in Tennessee. And his grandfather and his uncles, great uncles, were preachers, but he chose to turn away from the truth that I'm presenting. He said, no life after death, no ultimate foundation for ethics, no ultimate meaning for life, no free will. You see, morality has no basis, and he was basically saying there is no such thing as morality. You remember I said atheism leads to no coherent understanding of rationality, but it has no basis for right and wrong either. And that is the big issue. It loves to say that we make our own rules, we make our own sense of what's right and wrong, but it cannot answer it. Now look, I need to close, but I want to close on some important points. Schaefer said this, if a man is not made in the image of God, nothing then stands in the way of humanity. There is no good reason why mankind should be perceived as special. Human life is cheapened. We can see this in many of the major issues being debated in our society today. Abortion, infanticide, euthanasia, the increase of child abuse, and violence of all kinds, pornography, the routine torture of political prisoners in many parts of the world, crime explosion and random violence. And he wrote this way back in 1979. He was basically saying, if you take God out of the picture, not only do you lose reason, and he wrote one of his books with that in the title, Escape from Reason, not only do you lose reason, you lose what it is to be human. And people don't realize this. You cannot have a definition of humanity if God is not in the picture. You think you've just lost what you might consider a tyrant, but actually you've lost what it is to be human. Stephen Fry said years ago, that he didn't believe in God. Recently, in 2015, he did an interview where he says, how can I believe in God when there's so much suffering in the world? But the point is this, you cannot even make a judgment on that unless you've got God in your thinking, because you don't know what is right and wrong. So you cannot start accusing God of evil because by doing that, you're using the words evil. But evil has no meaning. So when Nietzsche said God is dead in 1883, and of course laid the foundations in a Germany which was collapsing morally because the church had lost its influence and had compromised with liberalism and was not believing its own book, it eventually led to the awfulness of the 1930s. Nietzsche said, God is dead. We have killed him, yet his shadow still looms. He died in 1900. Somebody wrote on a wall, Nietzsche is dead. You see, if the atheist was living forever, I might say, I need to listen to you. But because both you and I all die, we are not in command. Who is in command? Well, I haven't proved it conclusively, I know. But I've given you every evidence to say that there is a God. And we need to consider him. And the obvious contender is the Lord Jesus Christ. Because the Lord Jesus Christ said, I am the way, the truth and the life. No other religious leader ever said that he was the truth. And what is more, the evidence is there that people saw him, not only when he died, but when he rose again. Now you might say, dead people don't rise. But there is a lot of evidence which shows that that tomb really was empty. Because the people who hated the Christians, the Jews and the Romans, could not produce the dead body of Christ. And it's one of the most major pieces of evidence which shows to us that Christ really does need to be reckoned with. The book of Romans says this, the invisible things of him are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. I'm going to just let you ask some questions, and then I'll just round off after the last question with just a couple of minutes just to explain what it is, in my view, is the answer to this. I've pointed to you to Christ, but I haven't as yet told you what it is that Christ has done, which we need to consider. But let me just give you the chance to ask some questions, and then I'll round off and it'll just take a minute or so, it won't take very long, and then we can dive into that cake. So, who would like to ask a question at this point? Feel free. Yes, sir. At the back. At the back first and then you. There will be some who will say, well, what do I do, as Schrodinger said, with my emotions, physical pain, pleasure, pain, and all the other things. He talked about the aesthetics of red and blue. He was referring there to appreciating paintings and art. You know. Now, there are some who will try and suppress that because they say, I've got no way to actually understand what it means. There will be others who will be living in a split, almost schizophrenic way. Well, they'll dive into pleasure seeking, and say, well, what does it matter about seeking truth? I can't explain it, but I'm going to enjoy it anyway. So we live in a very hedonistic society where materialism has led to many simply saying that experience is all that matters. We live for the now. We live for the holidays. We live for the sunshine now. Forget the fact that there is going to be a bad day coming. Even within their own framework, they know there are bad days. Okay? So they can't make sense of it. So we actually do live in a split society. And some people just cannot. Those people who are really trying to think, and I believe Nagel really is thinking, Schrodinger really was thinking, Haldane really was thinking. And to be fair, even Dawkins, actually, does have a belief in a sort of absolute truth. But when he's cornered on this point, as to what is an absolute, you haven't got a basis for it, he won't answer the question. So even he is sort of living in a split mind situation. He's grasping for atheism because he knows the alternative is horrendous to say that there is a God whom I'm answerable to. So I don't know whether I really properly answered your question, but I think what it leads to is a split mind, because people have to acknowledge the reality of love, hate, issues which they have to deal with, particularly in law, right? So we have to make laws about all these things, but we've lost the basis of law. Yeah. Well, they didn't cancel it, but they almost did. They didn't pay my expenses. I never received any money from them for going there. I was amazed. Infanticide is coming. Yeah, I think it is, but I think you're right, actually. I think that is coming. Because the high priests of the scientific community are generally now atheists. And they call the shots, in the medical world in particular. And they call the shots as to what's going to be done. And you've got people like, what's his name, Peter, can't remember his surname, but Peter Singer, that's right, from Australia, who's trying to justify infanticide. And so, yeah, you are right, very sadly that is happening. There was another question, before I come to you, Mom. There was a question of the John, wasn't it? No, it's not John. It's, I don't know your name. Troy.
You mentioned a couple of times the C.S. Lewis's Lord Liar Lunatic Trilemma, which has been a very effective argument against atheists. They generally don't like calling Jesus one or the other. Have you come across much the invention of the fourth option, the legend?
Now, I've heard that said, and that some people have criticised. I forget now, the lady who debated Lewis, I think, was hinting at that fourth option in his day. There are a lot of people trying to say that it's just a legend and that Christ didn't really say these things, but actually, it's patently obvious that he must have done, because A, it's recorded in the book more than once, right? Okay, you haven't just got John 14:6, which I quoted, but you've got other statements where he says, come unto me, all you that labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Egotistical statements, right? Stressing his... You can't say that they're all mistaken, because these were recorded by people all round the Near East at the time. And of course, you then have to go into the documents and the reliability of the documents, the number of documents that there are. It's quite a lot of work to do, but we do have people who've looked at this and showed the reliability of the New Testament manuscripts. This is different to saying that they're true. Just the reliable record of what was said is pretty easy to prove, because there's so many of these manuscripts. They literally go into thousands. So I would say back to a person who says it's a legend, well, was it a legend that Julius Caesar invaded Britain? And of course it's not a legend. But how many documents have we got saying it? Very few. And what's the gap between the time when it happened and the time when it was put down? Is of the order of 500-600 years for the earliest manuscripts, for Caesar's Gallic Wars, which records all this. Whereas for the New Testament, the gap for some of them, the Rylands manuscript, goes back, is the fragment, it's just a fragment, it's about 30-40 years. And then some of the whole Gospels, we've got some which are not much more than about 100 years. So it's very, very reliable. The New Testament is very reliable indeed.